Hi, I'm Connie Dover, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff. Today, host Craig LeBeau talks with Lewis Webb Jr. from American Friends Service Committee and Trinity Carpenter from Kansas Appleseed about how race, poverty, and profit are part of the mechanisms of mass incarceration and the effect on families and communities. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. And now to Craig and his guests.
All right. Thank you for joining us here today. My topic today is mass incarceration, and we're going to talk about the numbers people are in prison, how it compares with other countries, how various states compare with other states, and some of the systemic problems that have led to the mass incarceration and what can be done and what is being done. I have two guests that join us by phone. One is Lewis Webb. Lewis is with the American Friends Service Committee. And we have Trinity Carpenter, who is a campaign director with a master's in social welfare from Kansas Appleseed, which is an organization that operates out of Lawrence. Welcome, Lewis and Trinity.
Morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Let's start with Lewis. First of all, can you give us a little bit about your background?
Certainly, yes. I've been working in criminal justice since I graduated from law school a very long time ago, 1991. I started off as a prosecutor in New York City, did that for about 11 years, and then I went on to serve as an attorney with the Department of Corrections in New York City, followed by a number of teaching opportunities within criminal justice and criminal law, and now I am an advocate for ending what we call mass incarceration and the over-incarceration of communities of color.
All right. And Trinity, can you give us a little bit of your background, too?
Absolutely. I recently just graduated from the University of Kansas the second time with a social work degree that is a concentration in macro social work. And so I aspire, Lewis. I definitely don't have the experience he yet has, but I am a true product of lived experience. And so I take that lens into everything I do, is that I come from these communities that suffer the most at the hands of incarceration, and I see the impacts firsthand. And I now know how to refer to the data and the outcomes to support that. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to be on today, and also to work at Kansas Appleseed.
All right. Let's start, Lewis. I want to deal with, if we can start with the numbers. First of all, if you can define what we mean by mass incarceration, and what are the numbers nationally, and how does that compare with other countries?
All right, so you've given me the most difficult question of all. How do we define mass incarceration? I think for me, it's an example of a trend to just continually incarcerate people for crimes that normally wouldn't require that level of reaction. And it's also the pure numbers. In the United States, we're still in that 2 million range. And when we look at that per capita, we're talking about a vast majority of people being subject to some form of criminal supervision. So it's not just putting people in prison. We're also talking about putting people on parole, house arrest, probation. There's a system that has figured out a way to identify a quarter of our population as people that need to be supervised. And when we look at that in relation to other, quote-unquote, first world countries, the numbers are just staggering. We go across the globe and we don't see anything comparable except in countries that we often identify as totalitarian. So when a country that lauds itself as a democracy, to realize that we are incarcerating 2 million of our citizens or fellow Americans, and otherwise controlling another 5 to 7 million, we're calling it mass incarceration, because when you're on the ground in these communities, that's what it feels like. It feels like we're just being picked up en masse and being taken away from our families and our work and our responsibilities. So mass incarceration is the over-incarceration of people that in the United States has amounted to 2 million in prison and 7 million under some level of state control.
Okay. And what do you see as some of the causes of that? And I guess one of the specific things I want to deal with is the crime rate. Do we have a higher crime rate than those other countries with less incarceration?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because it all starts, as I understand it, with what we put in our penal code. What do we criminalize? And as I've learned in this work, is that we often criminalize behavior that will target certain communities. So to be able to put someone in prison for marijuana possession, the war on drugs has certainly been a strategy used to uptick the level of incarceration in this country. What are some of the other things? I don't know if my colleague wants to join in, but I'd be certain to continue listing.
Okay, Trinity, do you have some insight on that?
Absolutely. For a long time, we have allowed like political ideology instead of crime rates or data to dictate the policy and response. And so our crime rates have not matched our incarceration rates for a long time. And people have broken it down for it to be more nuanced than that, because, of course, every city is unique, right? And their crime rates differ. And it still does not align with the amount of people we're incarcerating. And as he said, it is based on our penal code and what we criminalize and who we criminalize, and more importantly, the response, right, the outcome, how people are moving through our justice system and having very disparate outcomes. And so when the disparities exist, we know that's the presence of oppression. And so with that, I would definitely say that crime rates are not dictating why we're incarcerating people at this rate, but definitely what I would state, that not only political ideologies, but they're just outdated and it doesn't align with the data or what we're trying to accomplish. Well, ideally, we're trying to accomplish when we initiated these systems. And I feel like we've gotten away from that for a long time.
All right. Now, Lewis mentioned 7 million people who are under some form of supervision. And I guess views that, at least to some extent, a form of incarceration. My question on that, though, would be, isn't that preferable to sending somebody to prison? And the supervision, if it works, isn't the goal of that to keep people out of prison and reduce the incarceration rate?
What would, for me, be preferable is that we would shift and do prevention. If probation is helpful, that would be necessary. But if it's not helpful and we're doing it at extended periods of time that basically supervise and create an underclass of individuals for a lifetime, I don't think that is appropriate. And so when we shift to these probation models, recidivism becomes the next question, right? Like, why are people going back? Why are people failing? And at some point, people have to look at all the different factors, and it comes to support, access, circular reasoning, and all these things that are not to accommodate someone returning to their community and doing better, but having them under surveillance. And it's not easy to recover when you just either survived incarceration, or even if you have had a lifetime of, let's say, difficulty, and that you've committed a crime and they're trying to create an alternative where maybe that you are not incarcerated, as I said, it should be helpful. And so I'm a firm believer in even forgiveness programs. If we know that incarcerating and touches with the justice system come with stigma, we should be doing everything possible to invest in communities, especially communities that do represent this overrepresentation and disparities, because we're not really talking about just investing to avoid incarceration or supervision. We're talking about investing to combat histories of oppression that they're still surviving. And so it's really important for me for us to look to alternatives to keep people in the community as much as possible. At this point, I feel that's even best practice. However, I also think we need to look at solutions so where people are not carrying lifetimes of stigmas and having this barrier to social mobility.
All right. Now, you mentioned the term forgiveness programs. What do you mean by that?
A forgiveness program is a little different than diversion, because diversion, you have to usually abide by something for a certain amount of time, and then as long as you don't catch another, not catch, you see my language still isn't there, as long as you don't get are charged with another charge that isn't considered in your criminal background. A forgiveness program, especially for youth, is you have been charged with this criminal charge, and if you get to age 18 or if you can get to age 25 without catching another criminal charge, we'll completely forgive it. So it's not following you for a lifetime. And that gives people the opportunity to redeem themselves by not having these things follow them and further complicate. We know some people are, just by the indicators they're carrying, going to touch the justice system more than others. And so with that, I'm a firm believer in forgiveness programs. There's definitely states that have them. I'm a firm believer it definitely should be for all youth, especially youth that are getting felonies before the age of 18. That is setting them up for failure. And so I always put forgiveness programs on the table, and especially here in Kansas where we are doing juvenile justice reform. It's something I emphasize over and over again. I think something we can borrow from other states.
And one of the differences you mentioned with diversion, would that be with the forgiveness programs, would that be a situation where that would not be sealed and not available as a public record, which I think diversion records are available?
Yeah, absolutely. It would not follow you. It would not be something that could be held against you in the future. And so I think they're very beneficial, especially if we're trying to produce better outcomes. And so, like I said, I think they're valuable for shifting away from this punitive model that we've been trying to adhere to for a long time.
And when you talk about moving away from the punitive model, are we talking primarily as certain classes of crimes like drug crimes, especially drug possession crimes, and maybe misdemeanor assaults or things like that, while still keeping the punitive model for the much more serious crimes?
I am a firm believer in decarceration. I know that the contention of that is that certain people believe there are certain people that need to always be incarcerated. I would say that what they're actually talking about is secured care, and there is people that need secure care, but it doesn't have to look like our current incarceration system. And just the disparity of race alone, I feel, should make everyone go to a standstill and know that something is driving this outside of actual crime rates or public safety, because the outcomes of research also say that we're not improving public safety with our current practices. And so with that, I just envision incarceration looking completely different in the future. And I know we have a long ways to go. I just don't think this is it. I don't think anything with the foundations of our current system or what it has grown to be can work. And so I am more radical than most, but I am a person that believes in decarceration. And so I understand there are certain violent offenders, others that society doesn't think are able to function outside of incarceration. I just think it needs to look different than what it is. But I also think when you have drug policies and other things that are driving immense incarceration across the board, I definitely think them things immediately need to be looked at. And gratefully, a lot of people have. There's been immense reforms with the mandatory sentencing guidelines at state levels and in different places, and even with the ratio change that we had years back. And so there has been acknowledgement that the drug on wars did not work. The war on drugs did not work, and other practices have not worked. I just, I am more idealistic than most. And I definitely, like I said, I believe in a different system for everybody.
All right. And Lewis, let me ask you, Trinity used the term secured care. And I had seen an article and actually a video about the system in Norway. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, their system, but it showed they don't have, it's not locked facilities, but they are sentenced, they have to stay there. And it's a little bit, I don't know if I would call it halfway house, but they have intensive programs. Are you familiar with their program, and what are they doing that results in better outcomes?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I am somewhat aware of what's going on in countries like Norway and similar countries, and they do look like they're much better systems. I think Trinity is right on point when she lifted up that we don't have to incarcerate people under the conditions and for the length of time that we're doing it, even for what we call the worst of the worst. And countries like Norway and similar countries, they have an advantage that we don't have in this country, and that is that the people they're incarcerating look like the people who are deciding who goes and who doesn't, right? So when you look at a country, Norway or similar countries, that 99% of the population all looks the same, talks the same, dresses the same, eats the same, then you have that familiarity, that sense of this is my brother, this is my sister. In the United States and similar countries to ours, racism plays such a major role in who we decide to put in prison, how long we keep them in prison, that it would be great to model Norway's strategy. But before we do that, we've got to address what we clearly know to be one of the underlying factors, and that is the notion of the other. It is a lot easier to incarcerate someone who doesn't look, think, or talk like you. And that's the challenge that we have in this country. There's a reason 80% of the people in our prisons are people of color. It's not because they're more likely to commit crimes. It's just that they don't look like the people that are making these decisions on the bench, in the prosecutor's office, or in state and federal legislators. So if we really want to find a way to incarcerate less, incarcerate shorter, we've got to start talking about why are we doing this. And that brings up, in my opinion, the first issue, and that's race. So yeah, Norway is great, but until we become a one race country, we've got to acknowledge that.
All right.
We've allowed race to play a role.
Okay. And for those of you just joining us, we are talking with Lewis Webb from the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC, and Trinity Carpenter from Kansas Appleseed. And our producer, Jeff Humfeld, is on Facebook. If you have any questions or comments that you would like to make, you can go to our Facebook page, which is the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, and you can put in your question or comment under the post and post that, and then we will ask our guest to answer that. So I guess another aspect of what we were talking about with the racism issue would be the court process. To what extent are minorities facing a higher conviction rate? And how does that play into the conviction rate?
I think in my experience as a prosecutor, the clearest example of why people of color are more likely to be convicted and incarcerated is economics. When you have someone who's unable to hire an attorney who's dedicated to his or her case, has the resources to fully investigate and defend those who are arrested and prosecuted, you end up with a system that encourages, almost mandates, if not requires, plea bargaining. And when the prosecutor has that leverage where he or she knows that the person on the other side is not properly represented by counsel, then, you know, I can offer you 10 instead of 20, 5 instead of 15. And the truth is that unless you take that deal, you know, your trial is not likely to end in your favor, not because you're innocent or guilty, but because your defense team or your defense lawyer does not have the resources or the time to dedicate the amount of energy that's required to really defend you zealously. So if we connect poverty to race, which I think anyone who's thoughtful in this country can clearly do, then we see that if you go into the criminal justice system without resources, you are more likely to end up behind bars. So race, poverty, which are definitely inseparable in this country for reasons we could talk hours about, you're likely to get a higher percentage of people of color going to prison for no other reason than they accept plea bargains rather than face the ridiculous number of years that judges can hold over their heads when they know that their defense is not going to be as zealous as possible.
All right. And Trinity, what is being done in Kansas to try to correct some of those problems that Lewis just talked about?
At an adult level, I'm not as familiar as with what I'm just immersed in, which is the Juvenile Justice Reform, SB 367. And so that was specific to youth. I know years past, we did have a shift in policy within the Bill 123, which was to address, you know, drug addiction, other people that were overrepresented in the system. But I know with SB 367, it just basically said that you no longer can sentence people to incarceration for these low-level crimes when they're youth. The sentencing completely changed how they treated others within the system, like Sink and others. Basically, to me, what SB 367 said is that you got to treat these youth as youth and not juvenile offenders. You can't deem them a juvenile offender and then create this trajectory of them that is drastically different than other youth. And so I appreciate it, but we're a little too early to really assess for outcomes. We do know that those who are incarcerated has reduced. However, what's interesting, the disparity for race has grown. And so I think some of the things that we definitely have to address, and what we've seen here at Kansas Appleseed when we look at the data, the disparity is at every level of the justice system, but it begins with arrest. And it even starts as soon as school. And so looking for them prevention strategies, ways to prevent people from starting these trajectories and just increasing them. Like, we have communities in Kansas, Wyandotte, that over 70% of the youth who are in youth justice transition to the adult system. That is, like, to me, that's just alarming. And so we're setting people up with the stigma from the beginning, and just got to find ways, like I said, to do things differently, because it's not working and it's not sustainable.
And what was the percentage you just said that transitioned to the adult side?
It was over 70%. I think it's 77%. I didn't say that because I'm not completely confident, but I know it was over 70%, and I believe it to be actually 77%. And that comes from the work that's being done by Dr. Watson Thompson out of the University of Kansas, which the grant that is in Wyandotte to try to reduce youth violence. I've been familiar with a lot of that data because I got to work on the project. And when you look at that community and how economically disadvantaged they are, but then how much of a reality the justice system is their life, from grandparents to parents to youth, this is generational. And that's the impact for me that mass incarceration has on the community, is that it's generational.
We're due for a break. So, Lewis and Trinity, if you'll stay on the line, and we'll be back in just a few minutes with some more questions.
Now, the calendar for the week of October 1st. The KC Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, October 5th, beginning at 7:30 p.m., at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, KCMO. POMC meets to provide assistance through ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and awareness to all survivors of homicide victims. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, October 5th, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and basic human rights for those that are incarcerated. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's R-E-D-R-O-B, 2655 at yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, October 2nd, from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. Crossroads Correctional Family and Friends Advocacy Group will hold their monthly meeting Saturday, October 6th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Northeast Branch Library, 6000 Wilson Road, KCMO. There will be updates on conditions at CRCC and the lawsuit against the Department of Corrections. One of the keys to ending commercial sexual exploitation is to end the demand for the commodification of women and children. To end this demand, Veronica's Voice has put together a male focus group to help write a curriculum that will teach men about healthy masculinity and offer ongoing support to the men who want to continue in this journey. However, we are constantly seeking to add men from various ages, ethnicity, social classes, educational backgrounds, faith perspectives, sexual identities, and life experiences. If you would like to be a candidate for this focus group, please send an email to Vince at veronicasvoice.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. And now we return to Craig and his guest.
Okay, thank you. And we are back with our guest, Lewis Webb, who is with the American Friends Service Committee, and Trinity Carpenter, who is with Kansas Appleseed. And our topic is mass incarceration and a lot of different issues that relate to that. We are taking questions and comments by our Facebook page. So if you have a question or comment, go to the Jaws of Justice Radio on Facebook. And after you type in your message in the box, click send message on the right side of the column. And we will get those questions to our guest. Okay. Welcome back, Lewis and Trinity.
Thank you.
One of the questions, and this would be for Trinity, you described the forgiveness programs, and
yes,
a question that our producer actually had is, are we essentially talking about, is this the same as restorative justice programs, or is this different than that?
Restorative justice is something that is different. Restorative justice is like community-based, and what I have seen with restorative justice as of recent as is that it's not being implemented in what it was envisioned to be, which is an issue we have with lots of ideas, right, of things, how to change, how to make progress, is that we have these brilliant minds come up with them, and then we're tasked with implementing them, and then they do not really translate to what they're supposed to look like. And so I definitely believe in restorative justice. I've tried to shift my own terminology to transformative justice and get back to, like, the purpose and roots of it, which is that it was supposed to help the most disenfranchised, the marginalized. What I've seen happen is that it's being used for those who already have power and resources and access to a lot of the better outcomes when they navigate the justice system. The place I do see restorative practices working really well is in school districts. However, when I've seen them applied in criminal justice systems, I have not seen them go as well. Here in Douglas County in Lawrence, Kansas, we had one pilot for restorative justice, and it was applied to an ex-police officer for assault, and then no one else got access. And so things like that concern me. Because you're essentially moving something out of criminal court to a civil matter. So you no longer have that criminal component. If we can resolve this outside of the criminal courtroom, we can come up with a resolution. And the fact that that would be extended to those who already carry the most privilege in our society and communities is a concern for me.
All right. And, Lewis, when we were talking about some of the problems with the judicial system itself, and you talked about the economics and the inability of poor people to have effective representation, et cetera. What about for those who go to trial? Because we talked about racism issue. What impact do you see racism is having on juries and their decisions?
Right. Well, there are a number of layers that I believe impact that particular issue. And I think the first one is the one that we just have to accept and continue to battle, and that is as impartial and as open to the truth that we ask jurors to be prepared to do when they sit in that box. You know, we don't acknowledge or we don't lift up the fact that they bring their own biases, they bring their own predispositions. And that is a challenge that I wish I could figure out how to solve, but we need to acknowledge that when we put 12 people in a box and they're looking at someone who is going to be a person of color more likely than not, you know, what biases are they bringing that won't come up during the questioning prior to being selected? And then we also have to look at what we often call some of the collateral consequences of a criminal justice conviction. Our Constitution guarantees, at least on paper, being tried by a jury of your peers. However, if you are convicted of a crime in almost every state in this country, you lose the right to serve on the jury. So if we do the math, if you continue to incarcerate people of color at alarmingly disparate rates, you're going to more likely have a jury that doesn't look like the person on trial. And that presents, you know, the same problem.
All right. So I'm thinking, based on what you said, you know, one of the things that we frequently do as attorneys is if it looks like or people are expressing biases during voir dire, which for listeners who don't know what that term is, that's where we question the juries to try to weed out those who might not be fair. So if they express some biases and they acknowledge them, the tendency often is that those are the first that we strike from the jury pool. I wonder if maybe we're taking the wrong approach and that those are the ones that maybe we want to leave on, in the sense that if they recognize their biases and admit to them, that maybe they would also be the most capable of getting around making a decision without those biases influencing them.
That is actually, in my opinion, a very interesting but potentially dangerous strategy that if I were a defense attorney, I'd be leery of, but I think there is some logic to it, right? The person who's willing to acknowledge and admit to his or her bias, we hope, would also be the person who will try to acknowledge that during his or her deliberation and say, am I making this decision for reasons that I shouldn't? I think the dangerous juror is the one who acknowledges his or her bias internally but outwardly conceals it. And that's the one that I think you're right in saying we need to avoid. So it may be that defense attorneys should be much more mindful of asking questions that will elicit that bias, not in a threatening or condescending way, but in a way to remind the people in the jury box that, you know, we know who you are. We know who we are as a society. Let's put that on the table. Let's acknowledge who we are, and let's make sure that to the degree we can, not let that affect our decisions. So I'm somewhat impressed by your suggestion. I talk to defense attorneys all the time, and I will certainly wonder with them if it's a strategy that they think would best represent their clients. So thank you for that.
All right. And the next one I want to move to is some states have gone to, and federal government has gone to, sentencing guidelines. And Kansas is one of those with sentencing guidelines. So I'll ask Trinity to address this first, and then Lewis can chime in. Do those guidelines, and I think even the juvenile court system has established some guidelines too, does the idea of guidelines like that, does that help to reduce mass incarceration, or does it have no effect on it?
It has a huge effect, but not to reduce. I guess it matters what your sentencing guidelines are. And so we're seeing with the youth addressing the previous sentencing guidelines and reducing them has shown preliminary improvements. However, the mandatory sentencing guidelines we have now has had an enormous impact on mass incarceration. And this shift in policy alone allowed for, like, targeted and systemic response to very specific communities. This shifted the prison population from approximately, like, 200,000 in the 70s to the 2 million we see today. And as Lewis said, the 7 million that is also under supervision and other mechanisms. And so I think it basically eroded the judge's ability to assess for context or mitigating circumstances. I know there's documented cases of justices have chose to leave their bench instead of participate in the mandatory sentencing guidelines that was causing the balloon in incarceration that we've seen today. And I hate to say that standalone, though, because the war on drugs and mandatory sentencing guidelines and harsher penalties and three-strike laws and no tolerance definitely had an impact. But I want to say it's not the singular impact. And there's many other things that have fueled this, privatization and others. But I think the mandatory sentencing guidelines had an enormous impact and definitely has fueled the mass incarceration that we see stand today.
All right. Are you suggesting that having sentencing guidelines is not good, or just that we need to reform it? And let me tell you what I'm thinking of in terms of some experience I had. One, wouldn't there be an argument that with sentencing guidelines, you deal with, at least partially, reduce the impact of racism by the judges who are doing the sentencing? And then two, is that it's consistent in that your sentence is going to depend on what you did in your criminal history and not based upon who you happen to be lucky enough to get assigned as a judge. So the benefit, would you agree that those are two benefits that we do have with sentencing guidelines, and that instead of getting rid of sentencing guidelines, they need to reform it and get rid of some of the mandatory terms for drug offenses and that kind of stuff?
I will agree to the merit of both of those, but to me the flaw in that is if you already have those who are by just race alone bound to have a criminal history that is disparate to others, you're setting them up to still overrepresent our judicial system. I also basically know the concerns you're stating, but the sentencing guidelines that we currently have and even the reforms we're seeing are also not comparable to other countries. We have other countries that would give a year sentence for things that people can get 10 to 15 years for in the United States of America. And so I think that's important to notate. And I think it's also to notate how these tougher sentencing guidelines say that, you know, you have two of the previous crime, the third one is a felony, the impact that that has had alone. And so I definitely see the merits of that, and the debate in California with the whole bail taken away, and now judges, it can be up to a judge based on certain things, how long someone stays, and just the impact and unforeseen consequences of that, I think is something that we always have to assess for. But I think there should be basically a standard of what someone is doing in a courtroom, and it should be consistent. But to me, that is the issue, is that you can say sentencing guidelines is making something consistent unless certain people with resources at their disposal can circumvent them things, or there are ways in the judicial system set up for people to offset their sentences in ways that are making it more far-reaching. Let's say as my cooperation gets me a downward departure on my mandatory sentence, and so I'm inclined to now testify against all my co-defendants, and that testimony might even grow their charges. And so I've just seen some of the nuances and complexities that go into courtrooms and the motivations, and just as Lewis said before, the amount of time judges and prosecutors can hold over a person's head. But I will say, I'm a firm believer that the prosecutor is the most powerful person in the courtroom. And so I think reforms with prosecutor offices would translate to better outcomes than continuing to address. I think right now the sentencing guidelines as they stand cannot happen, and that needs to be addressed. But I don't want people to depend on basically making a matrix or a manual for something that is not that black and white. When someone stands in front of your courtroom, it is not that this is in your criminal background. If that was the case, I honestly would never probably stand in this position. And at the end of the day, you need people like me, right? We defy the odds. We have different outcomes than most that have my background, and we're the exceptionalism that needs to exist to uphold the system. But it's also very sad because there's millions of people behind me with the same charges as me that could never hold my position or had access to my education or the support that I get. And so I think it's way more complex than that. And I understand the merit of that motivation and understand why that would make sense in a academic or even conceptual sense, but not in application.
All right. And for those who have just joined us, we are talking about mass incarceration. If you have any questions or comments, you can go to our Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. And after you type in the message, click send message on the link on the right side, and we will get those questions to our guest. Want to talk a little bit about the impact of privatization on mass incarceration. And I'm thinking both of privatization of the prison industry in some states, as well as I have learned that in some states even that they are privatizing probation services. So, Lewis, can you comment on that?
Yeah, there is no doubt in my opinion and in the work that I do with my colleagues across the country that prison privatization and all of the ancillary privatization is nothing more than a new incentive or a newer incentive to incarcerate as many people as we can. Once we've put profiteering into the mix, then you get a whole new part of the population that supports mass incarceration. So when you have private prisons that have these capacity minimums that the state or the federal government have to pay regardless of who's in the bed, then, you know, the state says, well, we're paying for the bed, we might as well fill it up. We get an uptick in policing in certain communities, an uptick in prosecutions and convictions across the states. You also have privatization, as you said, of probation or probationary tools. one of the more interesting things that I've come across is the privatization of ankle bracelets. Right? These companies, technology companies, have all figured out a way to dive into a market of incarceration. Maybe not by building a prison, but by devising the best ankle bracelet or the best monitoring device that you can come up with, and they sell it for billions of dollars to states and the federal government as another tool of controlling people. So, yeah, there's no doubt that money can be the root of mass incarceration, and we're seeing that in the privatization question. So it's a player. It definitely is a player.
Okay. And thinking about different states, and I'll ask Lewis to address this first and then Trinity, are there programs in any of the states that you would consider to be model programs that are successfully reducing incarceration?
The sad answer for me is no. There are some that are closer to what I envision to be a model criminal justice system, but none that I think are close to actually realizing it. We have states in the upper Northeast that provide a level of humanity to those they incarcerate, be it access to the ballot, to general conditions of incarceration. But back to the original issue that I hope we have not lost, and that is those are the states that tend to be the whitest in the country, Maine and Vermont, right? So why are those people allowed to vote from their prison cells, and yet a state like Florida can deny the right to vote for the rest of your life after a felony conviction? Why are states that are more white less likely to incarcerate for long periods of time, less likely to use solitary confinement as a punishment tool while people are incarcerated? I hate to beat my drum continually, but until we address and continue to address the issue of race, then we're going to see as far away from a model system as possible in communities that have large populations of people of color. So, yeah, we can look at Maine, we can look at Vermont as a way towards a just system, but while we're looking at those, we also have to look at California, Florida, Georgia, and say, you know what? The big difference is race, guys, and let's acknowledge it and let's do what has to be done. Is it mandatory sentencing or sentencing guidelines so that you take that factor out of the equation? Maybe, but, you know, then you've got the opportunity to aggravate the sentence by upcharging by prosecutors or finding other aggravating circumstances from the bench. So it's really about acknowledging that race is a major player and responding to that in a way that it gets taken out of the equation as often and as effectively as possible. So no, I haven't found a model state. I do think that some are doing better than others. I think getting rid of bail, or at least cash bail, in New Jersey has been impressive, because that is certainly a major player into the number of people we put in prison. Better resourced legal aid and the defense bar would help, and I think Trinity is right. Holding prosecutors accountable for the racism that they bring to the table and the other, you know, career-building aspirations that they bring to the table all really contribute to why 2 million people are in jail or prison and 7 million people are under control.
All right.
We've got a lot of work to do, but there are places we can look for some guidance within the country.
Okay. And Lewis, we just got a question from a listener on Facebook page. It says, would you comment about the alarming trend of, quote, pay-to-stay model? And does that violate the Eighth Amendment as it relates to excessive fines?
I'd love to. I'm a little concerned that I'm not quite sure what the pay-to-stay model is. I don't know if Trinity, is that something specific to Kansas that I might not, or Missouri that I might not know about? But if someone can help me understand it, I'd be happy to try to share my thoughts around it then.
Okay, this is Jeff Humfeld. I'm the producer, and I think what the listener was referring to is similar to what just happened here in Jackson County, where they announced that they were going to make the inmates pay for their meals.
Oh, okay.
And basically what happens is they're still going to feed them, whether they can pay or not. But what happens is when they walk out the doors, they end up with a big debt.
Really? Wow. Okay. And, all right, so now with a better understanding, the question is...
Okay.
What was the question?
Well, are those programs, do they violate the Eighth Amendment as it relates to excessive fines?
You're asking me to be a constitutional scholar. That's going to be a challenge. You know, I want to say yes because it feels that way, but there's certainly a lot that I would have to think about and research to fully determine if we're looking at a Eighth Amendment violation. Is it a fine to charge someone to eat? It certainly seems inappropriate when you could just let them go and then they could pay for their food on the outside. But I appreciate the question, but would love to be able to think about it a little bit more before I can respond as to the constitutionality of it. But I think the thoughtfulness of the question is right on point. You know, pay to stay seems to be, if not excessive fine, something that's cruel under the circumstances.
All right. And, Lewis, we only have time for one more question. We've got about 30 seconds left.
Mm-hmm.
Are there, like, one to two key programs that the AFSC is promoting that would help reduce incarceration?
Yeah, I would certainly lift up my colleagues in Arizona, who I think are the national leaders on ending privatization and all of its manifestations in the criminal justice system. I think my colleagues in New Jersey and my office here in New York has strongly advocated for ending cash bail, which is definitely a feeder to mass incarceration. So those are the two that I can lift up right now, but, you know, even while we have people in prison.
All right.
You know,
so we do have to end it. Thank you, Lewis. And Trinity, and for those who just joined us, we were talking about mass incarceration, and we hope to have our guest on again in the future to talk some more about this.
Well, certainly.
Thank you.
And Trinity, nice talking with you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. This is George Mason, a white pastor in the city of Dallas.
It's been a hard week in Dallas. The fatal shooting of a young and impressive professional man named Botham Jean by an off-duty police officer, Amber Geiger, is a tragedy that has rocked the soul of this city. This police officer shot an unarmed citizen in his own home. The victim was black, the officer white, even if race didn't factor into the event initially. Nonetheless, the preferential treatment of the officer by the criminal justice system reminds us that justice in this city, in this country, is still not colorblind. Whether you are white or black or brown or blue. And then the smear campaign of the dead man's character started immediately after his funeral, which is a long and nasty practice used against people of color to gain sympathy for the defendant. Lord, have mercy. I sat for 3 hours Thursday in Botham's funeral service, thinking how touched I was by the faith of this man and of his family and of his church community, and also thinking, I don't want to have to attend one more of these funerals ever again in my entire life. And then Friday morning, I sat in a room with about a dozen to 15 Dallas pastors, including colleagues like Jeff Warren at Park Cities Baptist and Todd Wagner at Watermark, and black clergy like Brian Carter of Concord Baptist and T.D. Jakes of the Potter's House. Quite a room. We were there to talk with the district attorney, Faith Johnson, to hear how she was handling things from here, given the pain and anger that has the African-American community boiling over in outrage right now. After the DA left the room, things got honest. One black pastor thanked the white pastors for being there, but expressed frustration with what he called the way white churches have privatized the gospel so much so that it keeps our congregations from understanding that the call for justice is not optional for Christians. And he wondered why we don't speak out more. We leave it to them. They're on their own. Bishop Jakes talked about how hard it is convincing the black youths in his church to stay with the Christian way of following a nonviolent Jesus when they're hearing lots of things from other people who say, that's not getting us anywhere.
I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
1, 2, 3.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.